Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carl Shinneman, Director of Analytics and Review with Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and is available when they're interested in listening to it, which is basically whenever they want to download it and listen to it. Today we've got a great show. We have Bob Dybert, an eDiscovery attorney with the law firm of Frost, Brown, and Todd, based in Louisville, Kentucky, and Carol Chotsky, a nationally known records manager expert based in Indianapolis, Indiana. And we're going to talk about the relationship between records management and legal holds. And, you know, this is sort of an interesting show because I think I was joking with Bob about this. You know, I've put together these questions, and I feel like the connection between records management and legal holds is very close, but not apparent to a lot of people. So if I feel like a chef putting the ingredients together for what could be a very interesting show, as you both show the parallels, you know, without, you know, necessarily being in each other's area too closely. So we'll see how this plays out. Before I start, you know, I wanted to introduce the speakers, and Carol's been a longtime friend and a participant on a couple of previous podcasts and BNA audio broadcasts. She's the president, chair of the board, and president-elect of ARMA International. She, you know, in the past she was the president. That's a 10,000 member association dedicated to the profession of records management. She's a national records management consultant. She's an adjunct lecturer at the School of Library and Information Science at Indiana University, Bloomington. Has more than 30 years of experience in the records management field in every phase of the records life cycle in nearly every industry, including federal, state, and local government. BA, MA, and PhD from the University of Chicago. So you're more educated than me, Carol. You got a degree on me, I think, here. And her focus has been on taxonomies and classifications in her PhD studies, and she continues in this area, developing it with research and consulting and writing books and things like that. So, Carol, great having you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Okay, and Bob Dybert is an attorney at Frost, Brown, and Todd, and he's been litigating commercial transactions and business relationships for more than 20 years. Litigated cases under federal and state civil rights laws, both civil and criminal cases involving federal racketeering, influence, and corruption organization statute, and more than 15 years experience in the identification, preservation, production, and analysis of electronically stored information in a variety of investigative and litigation contexts. I had the opportunity to meet with Bob down in the Indianapolis area, and was thoroughly impressed with his wide range of experience in this area. And I said, we got to do a podcast. So that's how Bob got here. So, Bob, thanks for coming on this show as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Okay. So, you know, starting off, I always like to ask first question, you know, how did you get interested in electronic discovery, Bob? And then, Carol, you can answer that from a records management perspective.
I started working in electronic discovery really when I was a young lawyer. 20 years ago, we had a case where we were, commercial case, where we were seriously outnumbered, and we had to do electronic discovery of our own case in the form of creating a litigation support database just to keep track of all the documents and transcripts and evidentiary pleadings that we were getting from the other side. So we put together a team essentially to go from paper to electronic, and this was in the mid-1980s. And then in around 1991, I was handling an employment case where counsel for the other side wanted to look at the digital time and date stamps in an effort to prove that disciplinary documents had been either backdated or postdated as a pretext. So really, my interest and involvement has been on a case-specific basis for a long time, as these things have as the electronic properties of documents have taken on evidentiary significance. And then, of course, you know, in the last 10 years, the entire field has just exploded.
Carol, from a records management perspective, how did you get involved?
Well, we records managers finally got involved because legal counsel let us, and IT as well. And so it's not that we weren't screaming bloody murder for the last 50 years. It's that they finally realized that they needed our help to do it. So we've always been interested in the problems of litigation discovery, and records managers have always been involved. But with electronic discovery in particular, it's only been in the past 5-6 years that law and IT have started coming to us and saying that they need our help.
And, you know, that's great. So, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of follow the path I think a lot of people go down that haven't explored this, is we'll talk first about litigation and litigation holds, and then we'll talk about how it correlates to effective records management. That might be the wrong way to approach things, but that's, I think, not uncommon, right, Carol?
Yes.
So, starting with that, Bob, you know, if you could just give sort of an overview of what a litigation hold is and what the trigger point is.
Litigation hold, in the technical sense, is a freeze or a suspension of handling information in the ordinary course of business because of a pending legal proceeding, whether it's judicial or litigation hold usually refers to a judicial proceeding, but it also can be a regulatory proceeding or any kind of external action that, for legal reasons, that leads to a suspension of ordinary handling and disposal of information. The trigger point of that, when a hold is necessary, is going to depend on the context. When a lawsuit is filed, one of the first obligations is to identify the sources of potentially relevant information, the types of potentially relevant information, and put a hold on that. And that's a well-accepted situation. The courts, particularly the federal courts, have a broader standard, though. That is to say, a legal hold or litigation hold has to be put in place whenever there is reasonable anticipation of a proceeding. And reasonable anticipation becomes problematic when there's not a specific lawsuit on the horizon, but there's something that may be a dispute or something that is a dispute. And the courts have really addressed these situations on a case-by-case basis. The threat of administrative proceedings has been sufficient to trigger a hold. Demand for preservation because of a possible dispute has been enough to trigger a hold. Some courts have gone so far as to say that the factual circumstances in a particular case created an expectation of a dispute or proceedings that could lead to a preservation obligation, you know, months or years before a proceeding is actually filed. One of the safest practices to keep in mind from a management perspective might be to just keep in mind that whenever consulting counsel about a possible dispute, one of the issues to raise in that consultation is the likelihood of this dispute enough that we should think about putting a legal hold in place to preserve possible evidence?
And that can be sometimes challenging. I mean, there was one case that came down recently. A lot of people have talked about Adams v. Dell, where that trigger point was put back many years before the litigation was filed. That litigation was reasonably anticipated. Do you want to talk just so briefly about that case, because it's gotten a lot of attention?
Adams versus Dell is a federal case pending in the Federal District Court of Utah, and I think now it's captioned Adams versus Lenovo because Dell has been dismissed from the case. I believe Dell's dismissed from the case. The actual proceedings involved a different defendant, Asus Tech, I think. But in the context of the case was that plaintiff filed a motion for sanctions because one of the defendants allegedly had failed to start preserving information up to 5 years before the lawsuit was filed. And the court issued an opinion in March saying that sanctions were appropriate, but reserving on the type of sanctions because the litigation wasn't far enough along in discovery to determine the impact of what the defendant's lack of preservation had caused. But the court in that case focused really on two litigation hold issues and a records management issue. The litigation hold issues were that the court decided that there was an expectation of litigation because the defendant was aware of and might even have participated behind the scenes in some pending litigation up to 5 years ago, around the year 2000, based on this a technical issue in the litigation. So, and the court decided that expectation, and particularly if there was participation in a case, that was enough to trigger a preservation obligation. The second obligation arose from filing and pursuing a patent application in the same time period, and pursuing that patent application for a period of 5 years. And the court basically said that pursuing a disputed patent application can be enough of an expectation of litigation to trigger a hold obligation. Turning to the management perspective, the court also cited up to 20 years worth of case law to the effect that a party has to have in place some kind of management system that's adequate to control its records in anticipation of litigation, and that in assessing sanctions, which the court was going to do later in the case and still has not done as of today, the court said that the adequacy of the information management system is one of the factors to take into consideration when deciding what kind of sanctions to impose. So it's a significant case, not just because of the trigger points that the court identified up to 5 years before litigation had started, but also from the records management perspective, because it's a very extensive, I think 50-plus page federal opinion, which talks about the importance of having a good records management system in place as it relates to litigation holds and preservation of relevant information.
So, Carol, you got sales material now. My next question is, what's the trigger point usually for implementing effective records management programs? And, you got Adams v. Dell in hand now. but what are the trigger points for records management being put in place?
The trigger point changes depending upon the what's trendy. But right now, the trigger point is that companies are either being hit with subpoenas and being asked to provide records that are electronic, or they as one general counsel put it, they feel like they're dodging bullets. Another general counsel said he gets hives and he can't sleep at night thinking about what might be in the email system, and that's because of the education that they're getting about organizations' inability to produce documents. And this is in part a result of bigness, but in part a result of the shortening of discovery, the friendlier attitude about discovery within litigation, that you don't just play the other guy out until he doesn't have any money anymore. So what's happened is that the basically court rules have created a spotlight on your ability to produce documents quickly and to produce the right documents quickly. And as general counsels begin to recognize this, that's when they start to say, well, I guess we need a records management program.
So, Bob, you haven't done this records management approach, and now you've got a litigation hold. Who are the participants when you're doing a litigation hold?
The general obligation is to identify and preserve potentially relevant information. So the inquiry has to be, who are the potential witnesses, what information do they have, and where are the potential sources of information stored? And that it's not really, especially in in the current era, they're not always in the same place. So it, you can't just go into someone's office and look through their filing cabinet anymore. You've got to look at how their computer system is set up. Is it networked? Does the company outsource any of its communications, the BlackBerry servers hosted externally? Have they started to move some of their active data into a cloud provider, for example? Where are the third parties? And there was a case. This has become more important because a case in New York about 3 or 4 years ago called the attorneys in that case grossly negligent because they had neglected to follow up with a witness about in order to discover that significant information was contained on a network server. So it's a twofold inquiry. First, who are the relevant people? And second, where are the relevant locations of the potentially relevant information?
That's the Phoenix 4 case, I think.
Yes, Phoenix 4.
Okay. And then, Carol, who are the participants if you're doing this? And it sounds like litigation holds almost a subset of what could be good records management projects. So who are the participants in a records management project?
Well, usually we're looking inside the organization. Obviously, we're concerned about documents that might be maintained outside the organization, and we hope using policies and procedures to train people, for example, not to do SMS text messaging, which is then in the hands of the phone company, and for companies to understand that just as paper records need to have a good contract about who owns the documents and what happens when there's litigation, through ARMA, we're trying very hard to educate people about the cloud, for example, or any type of electronic outsourcing. But inside the organization, the key participants are legal, IT, and records management, and then obviously the department supervisor, any other participants, and companies are approaching that in different ways. Some of them realize that some of the employees may actually be involved in the problem and be the problem, and so you can't just willy-nilly assume that employees are going to produce everything that is relevant. And of course, since they're not the experts in the law, they may not know what is relevant. So one of the things we occasionally have to do is to bring in some legal temporaries to go through massive amounts of people's emails if they're involved. There are a lot of other problems there with people having 3,000, 40,000 emails in their inbox, which creates all kinds of problems. But the key members of that team are records management, IT, and legal.
Okay. Now, let's go back in the litigation world here. Let's say there's a reasonable anticipation of a case here in federal court, or you're under a state court obligation to preserve at this point. What are the steps undertaken when you implement a litigation hold?
First step is to identify the potential people who may be involved in the proceeding and the potential sources, the locations of the information, like we've discussed earlier. The next step is to put together some sort of written communication to document the need for a hold and the scope of the hold and the lines of responsibility for complying with the hold. To Carol's point about who is going to do the preservation, an issue to consider always is, do you preserve in place or do you try to collect immediately? That's going to be case-driven to a certain extent. Is there a risk that information may go missing because there may be individuals with personal exposure? Is one of the issues to consider in putting together and circulating the hold and relying on people to preserve in place as opposed to going out and making a quick collection. Once you've put those procedures in place and made that written communication, there's also not only there's a requirement of periodic follow-up, but it's also a good idea because as a business matter, litigation holds can be extremely disruptive, especially if you're putting the freeze on recycling of a lot of backup tapes. That expense can mount up in a hurry. So following up on the hold to more identify with more particularity the people involved and the sources of information involved can actually help narrow the scope of the hold that's necessary and put other parts of the organization back to the ordinary course of business.
And, you know,
go ahead.
We'll be dealing with backup tapes in the next couple of weeks. Craig Ball and Quinn Greger and there'll be one other panelist are going to talk about the challenges of backup tapes and what's reasonable and what is not. I'm really looking forward to that show.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, they did a great job, at least Craig and Quinn did, at the Georgetown Advanced eDiscovery Institute. And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why what we're talking about today is real important, and relying on backup tapes is like playing Russian roulette with your eDiscovery obligations in addition to the cost. So anyway, what I heard from you, Bob, is that, you know, I mean, there's some steps on the fly and trying to figure out where stuff is and, you know, trying to put a process together. Carol, if you're trying to do a records management project not on the fly, what are the steps that you'd be undertaking?
Well, we've had steps in records management for years and years because of tax audits and other types of regulatory audits. And the audits for litigation are similar in terms of their procedures, but slightly different in terms of the records and participation of employees. Obviously, with tax audits, it's a very clearly defined set of documents, and we usually know exactly what they are and probably where they are. And tax audits, a lot of people think those are over pretty quickly. I was in a holding company in New York where they had a tax audit that had been open for 15 years. So that can go on for a very long time. With litigation holds, the issue there is to find out, is it subject-based? Is it people-based? In other words, is there something related to an individual, related to a work group or a department? And then what we try to do is identify which record series are involved and then narrow those down to the work group, the individual, and then look at the type of document, the format it's in. Is it email? Is it spreadsheets? Because we want to be prepared to produce the stuff in whatever format is expected. And obviously, if you're producing an Excel spreadsheet, the problem there is that there may be formulae in there that you don't want to release or that must be released. And with email, you know, if you convert it to PDF, it looks just like a regular old-fashioned memorandum. And it may be that what people are interested in is the massive amounts of metadata associated with each email. So in terms of identification, we take legal's lead on that. But then we have very standard procedures for notifying people, for taking charge of those documents. And, of course, there's in situ, and there's, you know, taking hold of the documents, making copies, et cetera. So we work with legal on that. But the concept of a hold has been in records management for, you know, basically since before World War II. So this is not a new type of procedure for us.
From what you're describing, though, it sounds like there's usually an underlying engagement, like tax audit or something like that, which brings some records management professionals in, like yourself, to help assess what are we doing here with capturing information.
Well,
is that true, or does some people wake up, you know, chief operating officers, CEOs, say, this month we're going to really get better with our records management? I mean, is it normally pain-driven that there's a reason why we have to do this, or is it proactive?
It's pain-driven. Very few, I mean, stop and think about the irony here. We live in the information age, right? And everyone lauds the importance of information. And yet if you walk into a company like I do every day and see how information is treated, it looks like the floor of the bathroom. It's filthy. And you ask yourself, well, if it's that important, why are you treating it like, you know, the shack out in back of the building? It's an asset. It is, in fact, an intangible asset. And there are many, many articles and books written on the importance of business processes and in business processes as intangible assets, very few written on information as an intangible asset. It is not understood in organizations that if you treat information well, it will enhance what you do. And if you treat it poorly, you end up with the equivalent of slip and fall litigation, which you'll get a lot of. So on a normal day, a records manager is, most records managers are perfectly capable of dealing with litigation holds. The problem is when the litigation holds become so hard to implement, that's when they bring in people like me, because the underlying program is so undernourished and unattended. Obviously I have an annuity in terms of people's misunderstanding of the importance of information. For the rest of my life, I'm going to have work. But it just amazes me that people treat information like dirt.
Well, but there's a difference, I think, between there's a tension, I think, between information management and flexible use of knowledge. In the PCs came into widespread use because they're more flexible. They let users create and use content on the fly. And the most valuable evidence in litigation is not, it often may not be the structured report that is treated as a record series and held for a certain period of time. It's the informal email, or going back further, the handwritten note that someone thought was important, so they kept it handy for future reference. And the courts have struggled to find the balance between the need for an information management system that structures information and manages it in predictable ways, but also to accommodate and not undervalue the importance of the ad hoc knowledge that people create and keep close to hand, even if it's outside a normal record series. The cases go back many years saying that discovery can't be limited by an organization's records management system, even though the Adams case says, and properly so, a good information management system is a significant factor in determining how well a party has complied with its preservation obligation. So I think there's a balance between information management and developing and controlling the knowledge that's going to be relevant in a particular proceeding.
No one can deny that. However, by placing the concept of intangible assets, one of the things I've learned is that placing the concept of intangible assets versus the risk management side of information management is a false dichotomy. What we've discovered is that if you put a good records management program in place, and a good records management program doesn't manage just records, it manages every ounce of information that is outside of people's heads, including post-it notes and casual emails and so on. If you really put in a good program and have a good partnership between legal, IT, and records management, as well as lines of business, you do not have to spend more money for this, nor does it take more time.
You know, there was a good presentation at Georgetown, one of the large insurance companies, and I'm not sure which one it was, Allstate or Nationwide, was talking about how they manage flow of information. And almost every contact with them involves a claim. So they really have to take communication seriously as a record.
Yes.
And so they try only to touch things once. So I think you can make an ROI, but it lends itself to a question I was going to ask on proportionality, which might hold the answer here. But Bob, you know, proportionality, which is, you know, obviously one of the key buzzwords used for identifying common sense in electronic discovery, and it's written into the federal rules. How does that impact litigation holds? And Carol, maybe you can think about that with records management.
Proportionality in the federal rules is not so much a litigation hold concept as it is a production of information concept. The advisory comments to the 2006 federal amendments draw that specific distinction in saying that the proportionality that the party in federal litigation and in corresponding state proceedings has two obligations. The first, the preservation obligation, is to identify the sources of information that may contain relevant information. And those, in coming out of the box, those sources have to be preserved. And it's not, in the first instance, that's not a proportionality question, although it will be, and we'll get to that in a second. The proportionality question comes into play in deciding what is going to be the material that's actually reviewed and either produced or objected to in the first instance in the case. And that's where the dichotomy between active data and backup tapes, for example, or active and archived information comes into play. The rules don't recognize explicitly, but in any large organization, especially at the international scale, there has to be some notion of proportionality in what parts of the organization are going to be subjected to hold. And a good records management system that allows people, that allows the litigators to identify the people, identify the potentially relevant parts of the organization to put on hold, because of just a relevance, drawing the line of relevance, is the first step in proportionality. To go beyond that, I think that proportionality can come into play, but it should be, to the extent possible, transparent to the other side, and if necessary, going to the court to seek clarification on what the scope of a preservation duty is, because if there's information if there's relevant information that goes missing, the question is going to be, you know, well, why wasn't it preserved? And if the answer is, well, we thought to ourselves that it would be too expensive or time-consuming to preserve it, that can be a difficult point to sustain unless there's been some disclosure that, you know, a server located on one of the South Sea Islands for a remote exploration venture might have some peripheral relevance, but it's not worth the time and expense for anyone to go out and look at it. So proportionality can come into play in preservation, but it has to be handled carefully. And most civil rules provide for pre-litigation proceedings to preserve evidence or not preserve evidence, and those may come into play.
Yeah, and I'd like to note I did a podcast with Jonathan Redgrave and Judge Rosenbaum on proportionality. And, you know, one of the questions I asked the judge was about the obligations that companies struggle with in this age of electronically stored information. How far do you have to go even to implement a strong records management system if you're only getting sued 5 times a year or 10 times a year and maybe one big one every so often? And I think there was the judge recognized and said, you know, I think in this market, in this era, it's something that we need to be aware of and give some latitude to. But Carol, within records management, you know, looking at how do you tackle these problems, do you consider proportionality, or do the clients, you know, basically say, you know, this is our budget, you know, this is a proportional decision? how does it impact you?
One of the things that I've learned is that records managers tend to be 100% solution people, and it is very hard to get them to understand that that is not a business solution. There are no solutions that are 100%. And so what we try to do is work with them on their specific pain points, because, I mean, and I'm sure Bob can bear this out, companies usually get sued in a particular pattern set, and they know what pattern that is. So, you know, McDonald's gets 10,000 slip and fall litigations per year. That's their major form of litigation. You know, with some companies, they get more product liability, maybe only five, but they're, you know, each one is worth $5 million apiece. Another company may get more labor litigation. So what we try to do is work with them to prioritize where they go. The other thing is that you can't solve the whole problem right away. It takes 3 to 5 years to really work through the entire organization, because there are technological changes, there are training changes, there are behavioral changes, in addition to just the normal course of destroying records and holding them. So what we do is we try to create a prioritized roadmap for them to say, okay, you know, let's focus on these first, and then do this, and then do this. And make recommendations for each category of document for what they could do to sort of reduce the proportionality problems that they have. And they're the ones who know that, so we obviously take our lead mostly from legal counsel.
Bob, we missed over this one, but I know there are differences in litigation holds between different types of actions, civil, criminal, and just basically a record management project. You want to provide a couple of those examples?
The biggest differences involve the types of proceedings and the time frame for response. Civil litigation has, in the federal system, has been put on a progressively faster track in the last 10 years, so that it may be necessary to have the hold in place before the litigation is filed, and then to follow up on the hold to identify potentially relevant information and witnesses, and also those which will be deemed not subject to discovery in the first instance within the first 90 to 120 days of a proceeding. Federal regulatory proceedings or state regulatory proceedings can be on an even faster time frame, in as little as 30 to 45 days, or some criminal subpoenas may require turnaround even faster. If moving from civil to criminal proceedings also is a significant step, because after or in the wake of the Enron collapse, Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley amendments to the federal obstruction of justice statutes, which put more teeth into the laws against intentional destruction or withholding of information. And the federal government has initiated a couple of prosecutions, criminal prosecutions, based upon withholding evidence in civil proceedings or even withholding information in the course of an internal corporate investigation that turned into a securities investigation and securities proceeding. So the biggest differences, I think, are the time frame for response, and also the potential consequences of not having a sound process in place for identifying and either producing or objecting to a production of information.
You know, when you're doing these things on the fly, and you're not sure when there's been a trigger point, and you're relying on people to gather things, mistakes happen. So, you know, what do you do when a litigation hold doesn't work?
Well, the first step is to identify how far it went wrong, how to the extent to which it did not work, because at the end of the day, there still is a materiality test, and that is, when the process broke down, what's the extent of the damage? And if it can be shown that there was a temporary glitch that either didn't result in the loss of any information or resulted in the loss of information that can be obtained from elsewhere. And this is where information in the hands of third parties can actually be of a benefit. Then that's a manageable situation. If there's a likelihood that something significant has gone missing, then it can be important to be forthright with the court and forthright with the opposition and identify the situation and consult and take the best practical steps to remedy whatever hasn't worked.
But these are generally situations where, burying it is sometimes the punishment can be far worse than the letting people know we made a mistake.
And that's, well, the courts, different jurisdictions, and it's also necessary to check the law of the jurisdiction because there are some states that still don't recognize a general pre-suit obligation to preserve information at all. There are, at the other extreme, there are some jurisdictions that say that the negligent loss of information is sufficient to impose sanctions. And there's always the possibility that the court will say, well, the information, there's a likelihood that significant information has gone missing, but the court's not sure of the extent or the culpability involved, so it can be left to the jury or the judge in a bench trial as a matter of character and credibility of witnesses. There's an entire range of things that can happen, and it's important to identify, if the process hasn't worked, it's important to pin down how it didn't work and what the impact might be.
Carol, you've got obviously a lot of education and 30 years of experience in records management and information retrieval. Do you ever get called in to try to evaluate why litigation hold or management information didn't work and what you can do better?
No, which always surprises me because one of the things that records managers do is almost by instinct, because I don't know anybody who teaches this, we learn algorithms for finding things, and they're little analyses about what people do in certain situations, and it used to be that physical filing systems were actually created to reduce the problem of not being able to find things. But just as an example, I was doing some work for a city. They couldn't find a contract. They hadn't been able to find it for months, and they were starting to get very antsy about it. And I said, well, okay, then, I'll try to help you find it. And I found it within 5 minutes because I said, okay, when did it come in, and how long have you not been able to find it? And then I simply looked at a list of documents, other documents that they'd received that day, and looked where those were, and there it was, because what happened is people put things down and pick them up again, and if you happen to put two pieces of paper down on top of a third piece of paper, you'll probably pick up all three. And the same thing works in electronic records. Obviously, the algorithms are very different, but it surprises me when I hear the legal department say, this showed up 3 months after the litigation was over, and I was very worried. It turned out it wasn't important. But what do I do? And that's because they are not using the wonderful resources they have in records management. Who would know either A, where it is, or B, how to find it if it's lost, particularly when you have a good program in place.
Okay, interesting. Bob, you've outlined some of the steps you go through to put the litigation hold in place, some of the time frames. Obviously, this is all under the obligation of getting it in place quickly. Is there any ever time to test the litigation hold, or does that come up when oops situations occur, like when talking to witnesses and things like that?
Well, the hold is going to be tested as a practical matter in the ability to sit down with witnesses later in the case and assure that they preserved everything they were supposed to preserve, and that in fact you're able to get the information that you need to pursue or defend the proceeding successfully. So there's going to be a practical test as to whether there is a formal test. It's a good idea, and I really like Carol's reference to algorithms, because there are going to be situations where information comes in from third parties that wasn't seen in an initial preservation or an initial quick look or initial early case assessment. And that's an occasion to go back and look at the whole process to find out why that particular piece of information didn't turn up. Is it possible to fine-tune the search and retrieval technique to find that information, or at a minimum to identify that particular gap in the discovery process to see if the hold needs to be broader, if more people need to be included in it, if information needs to be searched in a different way. So it's a luxury in a lot of cases, but if there's an opportunity to integrate the litigation hold into case planning and refine it as part of case investigation, that's a form of testing that can really help in preparation and pursuit of the overall case.
And Carol, when you're doing more of a pure records management project, do you ever pick up the rock of records management and see if it's working, or is this an unpleasant experience?
Well, that's actually my job, is to go into companies.
I made a reference to bones in my question.
Yeah.
Joe, where you're looking at dead bodies here.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's ugly. It is really ugly. And you hear things that just curl your hair. And quite honestly, I've walked out of a Fortune 100 company and checked my 401k to make sure I wasn't invested in them.
Things don't decay when you lift them up. It's just usually they're not there.
You really see and hear practices that, and people say this without getting flustered or aggravated, and I have never heard of a records management consultant being subpoenaed. We don't have attorney-client privilege, but we hear things that just curl my hair, and, I'm just sure I've seen everything. Companies where people say, oh, yeah, when somebody gets fired, the supervisor just goes in there and deletes all the email. Oh, my God. Well, you have to say, well, okay, that's not a very good thing to do. But every day, that's what my job is, to go in and pick up the rock and look at underneath to see what's decaying and scurrying away, and then help the organization get themselves back on the right track. And in terms of testing, it gets tested right away. Very rarely do we have the luxury of not seeing it tested. The problem is then, with everybody screaming very loudly, what is the situation? And that's why we do audits after we've implemented a program to see, are various things actually getting implemented, or are these outlying problems that are forcing us to run around with our hair on fire.
Bob, this is a little bit off topic, but not completely, because Carol mentioned the movement towards more cooperation in the discovery process between litigants. Are there any unique issues with privilege when you're implementing litigation holds that can be impacted by showing the process of your litigation hold, following these cooperation initiatives, that litigant can inadvertently end up waiving privilege?
As a practical matter, probably not, for at least in the federal system, for two reasons. The first is Evidence Rule 502 was passed in the fall of last year, 2008, and it provides for the express preservation and non-waiver of privilege so long as the parties discuss and agree to it, and ideally have it expressed in the form of a court order, which can be binding in other federal proceedings and also upon other non-federal proceedings as well. So it's possible, looking at the back end, it's possible to preserve privilege against waiver issues. in the first instance, the courts are developing an approach, sort of a twofold approach, again, in the federal system, where hold-related communications are probably privileged or work product in the first instance. But if those communications are become an issue because information seems to have gone missing, then the courts have found a variety of ways to hold that either the privilege has no longer applies because the integrity of the communications are put into issue, or if there is any protection, then the protection had to be waived in order to rely on the communications. Now, those are federal developments. I agree with your point is very good that for state-level proceedings, it's necessary to look at the case law in a particular jurisdiction because there may be some jurisdictions that still apply a notion of strict waiver, which could, if there is any disclosure of any communication, then it could be a waiver as to the subject matter. And the specific jurisdictional law has to be checked in each case, but the federal system is moving toward a balanced, trying to find a balance between recognizing privilege and getting the information that the court needs to determine the situation accurately.
Last question I really want to focus on here is the reality of paper versus electronic records. We still have to deal with paper in all cases. Is it good, Carol, to be trying to build process around the reality that most records are electronic, or do you just have to accept the fact you're going to have some paper in there and live with two different types of systems?
Well, we're seeing a transition in most organizations to more electronic. There's still paper everywhere, what we're finding now is that the use of paper is more dependent upon personality than age. And so you do have to work paper into it. And one of the things that I require when we go in and do an inventory is for people to say how many different media they use and then what systems they're using to create the stuff. And it amazes me how many are primarily paper and not email, not electronic. There's a lot of electronic stuff out there, but they're not using that as the primary source. So it depends upon the type of organization, what they do. And so on, but you have to have a hybrid system. You cannot go with just one type.
Yeah, it's hopefully we'll get to the more of the electronic world. It's so much easier to share information and access it when it's electronic than when it's paper.
Yes. Well, and that's what the technology was designed for. Just as Bob said, it was designed to create it and to distribute it, but not to manage it.
Well. Any last points either of you want to mention about connecting records management and litigation holds? I'll start with you, Bob, and then Carol.
Just to follow up quickly on your last point, I think that paper still is important to litigation and records management because even though we have increasing use of electronic information, there's still the comfort of having a significant piece of paper sitting in hand or sitting in a meeting and taking notes of what's going on during the electronic presentation so that any system for legal holds and in the broader management context has to address both. I think that if there's a way to provide for a migration of paper into an electronic management system, that's a luxury because we don't see it done often, or when we do see it, it's not done particularly with a lot of efficiency, but paper is still important, and I think that paper is going to continue to be important even as we use more electronic communication. So it's something that we have to keep in mind from the hold perspective.
Great. Well, Carol, do you want to take the stab on trying to link the two together, and then Bob, if you want to follow up?
Well, it's wonderful that we have attorneys like Bob who understand, and the Sedona Conference, and you, Carl, who understand that records management is a really important component of making discovery work. And I would echo what Bob says, that if you create a good records management program, one of the things you're going to try to do is get things into one type of medium, and electronic really is preferred, and then to use paper simply as a convenience resource that can and should be thrown away as soon as possible. And I do wish that people would understand, though, that you don't have to, it doesn't take more time and it doesn't cost more money to create a records management program that not only reduces the risk of litigation, but also enhances the asset value of information.
Okay. I don't know, Bob, if you have anything to add to that. You're complimented there at the end, so sometimes it's good just to fold at that point and say.
Yeah, it's tempting to be quiet while I'm ahead, and I've had more than one judge agree with that notion. But I think Carol's last point, I think, is really something for people to take away, and that is a little bit of time and expense in planning, putting a process in place to include legal holds in the larger records management program, that can save just enormous amounts of time and untold amounts of money when the litigation arrives. Because litigation it's the one point where everyone can see just how much money it costs to wade through trash in order to get to the important information that's going to decide a proceeding. And if you've got a policy, if you have a process in place that minimizes the trash and increases the speed with which you can get through information to find the knowledge that's necessary to deciding the case, that just it makes common sense, and it can save a lot of dollars and cents.
Well, that's always popular to hear. Bob, Carol, thank you for joining our show. Very interesting stuff. To our listeners, thank you for listening to our show. For a complete list of ESI Bytes shows, you can visit www.esibytes.com with a Y. It's easy to remember. My good friend Jeff Reed says it's Easy Bytes, which is ESI. ESI Bytes. It's one way to remember it. But just remember also what we always say here. You should visit ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. Thank you again. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, and have a nice day.